You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey, it's Mae Whitman, and I play Frankie in the new Realm podcast, The Sisters. The Sisters is about a museum curator of medical oddities who investigates the origins of a mutated skeleton with two layers of bones. Soon, she uncovers an extraordinary mystery that connects her present with one family's tragic past in hauntingly dangerous ways. Listen to The Sisters wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Muses and Stuff. This is the podcast that's all about the dolls. They were the groupies, the wives, the girlfriends, and the muses who played such a huge role in rock and roll history by simply being themselves.
They were sweet, sexy, brave, and powerful. They went after what and who they wanted, and they made no apologies.
We are your hosts, Shanti and Lynx.
Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
This episode is brought to you by Electrified Porcupine. Electrified Porcupine is a pretty kick-ass website where you can go and read and learn all about music, gaming, wrestling, retro, TV, movies, cartoons, and collectible toys. So go to electrifiedporcupine.com and have a look around. See what you like.
What's he doing?
just chilling out. He's ready to record. We're ready to record. Let's do this. Okay. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Muses and Stuff, your favorite podcast about groupies.
Yes.
Your only podcast about groupies.
How are you, Shanti?
I'm doing great. Thank you. It's a beautiful Saturday afternoon. The streetcar ride was sweaty, and I'm barely wearing any clothing, but I wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah, finally. It's been long enough.
It's been a winter.
Yeah.
Yes, but I'm excited to be here, and I'm excited to do this new episode. We've got a couple of handsome men over at your place right now, one including your cat, CK,
mm-hmm.
and the other one including our guest for this week.
Yes. So, Alex Bird is with us. I know Alex because we work together. And he's here to help tell the story of Bobby Darin and Sandra Dee.
And why did you choose Alex to come and help you with this episode today?
Well, when I had already been working for a while, and when Alex came in, I knew right away that we were going to get along.
I was going to say, like, besides the fact that he looks like a crooner from the 1950s.
Well, he is a modern crooner, so... The look applies.
Does that mean he's romantic?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you know him from work?
Yes, and Alex is an amazing musician and an actor. He's just like Bobby Darin. He does it all.
So, okay, so I have no idea anything about Bobby Darin or Sandra Dee, so a lot of this is going to just be you, both of you having these conversations. I'm just here to produce this episode and make sure that everything is sounding and looking fine, which I realized on my way here, I'm like, I'm a producer. I've never called myself that before. I'm a producer of a podcast.
Yes.
Among my many talents. So I will soon hand over the microphone to Alex, and then I will interject from time to time and be like, wait, what? Or be like, no way, because I'm sure I'm going to like learn some shocking and wonderful and interesting pieces of information for this episode. So
you get to sit back and we'll do the work for you.
Fantastic. I'm going to pour myself another glass of raspberry iced tea and relax, and I will hand over the microphone to Alex. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So yeah, Alex, before we get into Sandra and Bobby's story, tell us and the listeners a little bit about yourself.
Oh my gosh, that's such a daunting task. Yeah. I'm a jazz singer in Toronto. I'm trying to groove it. Been singing for about 10 years, and the past 3-4 years or so, I've sort of been putting myself out there and trying to get gigs and getting my voice out there. And in terms of school, I went to theater school, and then I went to film school, and then I just started acting and doing that sort of stuff. So I've had a really good run the past probably 2 years or so, booking some shows on a couple CBC shows. I just booked a new CBC series today that I can't talk about anything else except for that.
That's amazing.
So yeah.
Thank you.
So things are moving along.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. One thing I really liked, I've seen a couple of your TV appearances and such, and I find it so fascinating that you always tend to get like vintage.
Oh yeah.
Type of roles.
I'm being pigeonholed with vintage stuff, but that's
with a face like that.
it's totally all right with me, because work is work, and I've always been labeled the time traveler in my group of friends.
So. Yeah. It must be so much fun to get into those old costumes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's glorious. Yeah.
See yourself like that. And you also perform live doing jazz shows in Toronto. I know you did like a burlesque.
Yeah, I did a burlesque show for a while. I kept my clothes on, which is for the best. And then I just did a gig at a wonderful club on college called the Night Owl.
Oh, yeah.
So we had an event there, and there's actually a documentary being made about my jazz singing right now. So the crew's been following me around, and we've been doing gigs and stuff like that. And
that's so awesome.
It should be cool.
Yeah. And this is your second podcast, right?
Correct.
You were actually did one with our friend Alex at the Never Sleeps Network.
Yeah, we had a really nice time.
Yeah, and so anyone who wants to get deep in,
oh, that's where everything is.
Yeah. Check out Ross Never Sleeps, and that episode is great. We were listening to it earlier.
Thank you.
Yeah. So before we get like really deep into Bobby and Sandra, I just wanted to tell listeners, this is a hard episode to listen to, maybe for some. Sandra went through some really rough things in her childhood, and we are going to discuss things like sexual abuse and eating disorder. So if that's something you don't want to listen to, then maybe this episode isn't for you. But we'll do our best. And do you want to talk about Bobby? Oh, first, actually, I wanted to ask you.
Yes.
I've always wondered, is crooner like a bad word?
No, not necessarily. Lounge lizard would be a bad word. crooner's okay. I don't mind if people say that.
But, okay. I know, like, didn't like Sinatra.
Yeah, why would it be a bad word?
Well, they didn't like it because technically crooners, so before, this is really, I don't know, not, before Bing Crosby like came into it, there were some singers in the early 20s that had sort of crooner voices. They were sort of big bellowing voices, and so they were technically crooners. And then Bing Crosby came around, and he sort of was a crooner, but he was moving more towards like popular singing and jazz. When Sinatra came along and changed everything, he labeled himself as, you know, a popular singer. And so when people called him a crooner, he didn't necessarily agree with that, because crooning to him was those people from the 20s, which wasn't what he was doing. Mm. So, and now today people say crooner and they think about Sinatra and Dean.
Yeah, it's definitely become like a more respected kind of term. And it does fit. Like when you hear that word, you do get like a sound in your head of
Oh, yeah, yeah. The definition has completely changed from when people might have been calling Sinatra a crooner, for
exactly.
instance.
Exactly. All right, well, so we can call Bobby a crooner without it being an insult.
No, I think, well, he was more than a crooner. He was,
yeah.
He defied so many different genres of music. Mm. I mean, he started in rock and roll, and then he went to jazz, and then he went to folk, and then he went to protest songs, and then he went to Motown, and then he did rock and roll.
Yeah, he was really, he did not stay in one category.
No, not at all.
He wanted to do it all, and he did, which is amazing. Mm. So, yeah, let's talk about Bobby's childhood.
Mm-hmm.
First, he was born not Bobby Darin, but...
No.
Walden Robert Casotto.
Casado. Yeah, which is a mouthful,
yeah.
Which I can understand why he changed his name.
Yeah, I had trouble just getting that out myself. it doesn't flow very... Walden Robert...
Casado.
Mm-hmm. All right. And he was born May 14th, 1936.
Can I just say this about Walden? I grew up in the county of Walden.
Wow.
There you go. You don't hear Walden too often.
No, I think this is like the only time I've ever heard Walden.
There you go.
Yeah.
Go Walden Devils.
So Bobby was born in East Harlem. Do you want to tell the situation about his mother?
Yeah, so it's, well, that would be, well, I mean, okay. So I'm going to say it off the top. When Bobby was later in his life, he found out that his sister was actually his mother.
Mm-hmm.
And so that changed everything for him.
Mm-hmm.
That's when he took off the toupee and grew a mustache and wore denim tuxedos. And
we'll get to that.
Yeah, we'll get to that. But essentially, his sister, who was actually his mother, she was 17. She was unmarried. She had Bobby. And there was a lot of people weren't necessarily nice to single mothers with no fathers back
then.
There
was a stigma there.
Especially the children.
Mm-hmm.
So she agreed with her mother that Bobby would be her son because she was married and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So
Bobby's grandmother, Polly, was now his mother. And his mother, Nina, was actually called his sister from birth.
I hope everyone's following.
Yeah.
My friends, like, I have a friend whose aunt and grandmother had, like, the same situation. It's, like, a not that uncommon of a thing
yeah.
to have happened
yeah.
in the
Actually,
past.
There's another famous man who had this happen. Do you know who?
No.
Jack Nicholson.
Oh, really?
And he actually found out in his 30s as well. But he found out because some journalist from, like, People Magazine or something...
found a story.
Wow. And so he learned it in print.
That sucks.
Yeah. So yeah, and especially like with older print, people,
mm-hmm.
that probably was quite common,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately. Nino at the time was dating a man named Charlie Mafia.
Yes. Yeah.
And they would get married, and Nina would have two daughters and a son with him.
Mm-hmm.
So Bobby had.
It's yeah. So he basically was he had siblings, and Charlie was pretty much his father.
Yeah,
pretty
yeah.
much.
And later, Charlie became his like valet or whatever.
Yeah, he became his driver, bag carrier,
mm-hmm.
muscle.
So Bobby had a rough childhood.
Mm-hmm.
He got sick.
Yeah, when he was about. 13, 14 years old, he had rheumatic fever.
Yeah.
And he spent most of his childhood in bed while the other kids were sort of like playing outside. He could
mm-hmm.
hear them and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he overheard the doctor talking to his mother one night saying he won't make it past like, I don't know, his 18th
yeah.
birthday.
And so yeah, he lived with that.
Yeah, that's a lot for a kid to take in, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had the rheumatic fever four times from when he was like 8 to 13, and that all like that affects your heart. So he had a heart condition like from then on as well. So Bobby grew up in East Harlem.
Mm-hmm.
He considered like the lowest of the low, very poor neighborhood.
Oh, very much so, yeah.
His family does say that they weren't the poorest ones on the block, but
no, but he had a recollection that it was pretty tough.
Yeah. And because he was sick all his childhood, his family sort of pampered him, and he sort of got this, everyone catered to him.
Of course, yeah.
And because of that, he sort of went through life with that sort of attitude, like everyone, everyone's here for me, I guess. Mm-hmm. Not like, it's not his fault either.
No, it's what he knew because he was so sick as a kid.
Exactly. So, yeah, being in that poor neighborhood, that was definitely like not where he wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And by 16, he left home and he was starting a band.
Yes, yeah.
But he wasn't a singer then.
No, he wasn't a singer yet. This is sort of around the period. So he got really into instruments because when he was sick in bed, his grandmother used to bring him, and his Charlie, his father, used to bring him instruments. Mm-hmm. And his grandmother used to be in vaudeville, so she taught him all the dance moves. She taught him how to play piano. She taught him how to sing all the old songs. Mm-hmm. So he basically just learned music when he was sick. So when he decided to start a band, I believe he was on drums.
Yeah.
And he hadn't started singing yet. Mm-hmm. But that sort of led to his whole... he got taken on as a songwriter.
Mm.
And he started doing that before he was discovered singing.
Yeah. I have a quote here from one of his friends, John Miller. He said, "Bobby thought he was going to die at any minute. He was very fatalistic about it. He accepted it. He felt he had to live the way he did because he had a very short time. He said his death was inevitable and it was going to come one day fast." So Bobby's young, still a teenager, and he's living life to the fullest.
What year is this?
This would have been...
like mid 40s, early 50s?
This would have been probably the early 50s.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he's like 15, 16. So, yeah, he was hitting the pavement, trying to get noticed. It's around this time he had his first sort of love affair, and it was with another famous singer, Connie Francis.
Mm-hmm.
In her autobiography, Who's Sorry Now, she says...
Nice name.
Yeah, that's one of her songs, but I mean, still, it's... But she also had a kind of rough life.
She had a rough life.
Yeah.
Everybody has a rough life, though.
Yeah, that's true. She said that that was the most bittersweet period of her life, and her whole world revolved around Bobby. Everything he did, everything he said, every dream he had for him and me... Life took on all sorts of delicious new dimensions now that Bobby was in it. Ours was a starry-eyed romance, hand-holding over shared egg salad sandwiches and Hanson's drugstore, and dreaming the most stupendous dreams together.
It's the most romantic thing I've ever heard.
Yeah. Bobby, though, was of the old mindset. There's girls you marry and there's girls you have fun with. So all this time, Bobby was, you know, with Connie and they had their thing, but he was also like sleeping with other women. And apparently he told Connie that he needed to have sex to keep his skin clear. And she believed that.
Oldest trick in the book.
But she also said, like, that it didn't bother her at all. She never felt threatened by the women. She knew that, like, they were together, and if Bobby needed to, like, get his...
Why do you think I have such beautiful skin?
Is that how you get that refreshing glow?
Yes.
Okay. So, yeah, Connie and Bobby, like, really were in love, but her father really did not like Bobby.
No, not at all. Yeah,
I think there's a story about him, like,
yeah, he Bobby was backstage at one of her shows and he pulled a gun on Bobby and chased him out of the building.
Yeah, so yeah, he didn't really like Bobby. Not a fan. And one time he actually kicked Connie out and like left her luggage on the doorstep. And Bobby actually proposed to her and said, hey, like, let's do this. But Connie didn't want to betray her father.
And how old is Bobby at this point?
Like 17, maybe? 18?
Yeah, probably. He's probably, yeah, mid-teens.
Yeah.
I actually have, because at this time I mentioned Bobby was trying to make it as a songwriter. And he was working with a guy named Don Kirshner, who became one of the biggest producers and songwriters in America.
Mm-hmm.
But they were working at a little place called the Brill Building, which was essentially the place where any of the hits that came out during that time, this is where they were made.
And Carole King was there, one of the songwriters. Yeah.
So I have in my possession a songwriting contract. It was Bobby wrote it. It's Bobby and Don. And on the contract, he signed it Bob Darin, and it's got Cusato sort of in the brackets.
Amazing.
But it's a song that he wrote called My First Year of Love.
Mm-hmm.
That song was passed to Connie Francis, and Connie Francis recorded it.
Yes.
And that's the song that brought them together, and they met because of the song, and I have the contract for
Amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's like 1953 or 4 or something.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It's pretty cool.
That's so beautiful, too, like, especially knowing, like, their relationship after. And
yeah,
it.
So that's, that. As far as I can find out in terms of information, it's that song that brought them together.
Brought them together, yeah, yeah, that's amazing. Connie didn't want to betray her dad. She ended up turning down Bobby.
Hmm.
Bobby did not take that well, and they split up. It just wasn't meant to be. Connie did marry 4 other men later in life, but she said she always regretted letting Bobby go. She said, Bobby was my first and last love. I never really loved anyone the way I loved him. He was dynamic and I trusted him completely, but we were star-crossed lovers.
Sometimes that has to happen.
Yes. So, yes. Bobby was still Walden at that point, but that was about to change.
Yeah. Although people did call him sort of
Bobby.
Yeah, by like a
the nickname. Robert. Yeah, yeah. So George Scheck,
mm-hmm.
who was, I think, Connie's manager.
Yes.
Yeah. He was, I guess, was working with him songwriting and stuff. Mm-hmm. And George asked him to get someone to like lie down a track. Bobby did it himself, and when George heard Bobby's voice, he was like, wow, like, gotta sign you. So Bobby became part of Decca Records then, and they would release about 6 of his singles, but none of them really went anywhere.
No.
Do you like any of those songs? Do you know those ones?
The first ones?
Yeah.
Well, I know his... The one that got him the biggest sort of praise was this song called Rock Island Line.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget what show. He actually did a TV appearance of it. It was his first TV appearance. And he was on the show and Elvis was on the show.
Oh, no.
And Bobby forgot the words to the song. He didn't have it. So what he did is he devised this method. And you can see the clip online. He's singing the song and he's doing these hand movements and he's looking around. It's because he wrote the lyrics on his hand
and he was so looking at,
like,
the
referring to it. So that was Rock Island Line. That was like the biggest Decca one that he sort
that
of
he did.
Got from there.
But yeah, that didn't really work out. They ended up dropping him as a client or as a artist. But he was still playing gigs. It wasn't soon after that he met a DJ known as Murray the K. And one day he heard Murray talking to his mom, who wanted to be a songwriter. And she had some wacky idea about a song with the lyrics Splish Splash Take a Bath.
Mm-hmm.
And Bobby thought that sounded awesome and was like, I'm going to write that song and it's going to be great.
He wrote that song?
Yep.
I used to sing that song when I was in the bath.
Yeah.
I think we all did.
Someone bet him that he couldn't write that song, and they had like a little bit of time left in the session, and he wrote it in 20 minutes, and then they recorded it.
Yeah. And they knew right away it was going to be a hit. Dick Clark invited him on American Bandstand.
That was a massive, massive show at the time.
Yeah. And apparently there's like just like a smattering of applause when he came on. But by the end, the audience like was his. And
oh, yeah, absolutely.
That was like, and he was 22. And that year he would earn over $40,000. And by all rights, he'd made it. Mm-hmm. But he said, as great as... I am as grateful for the things that happened to me in the 4 short years that I've in the business as I am for God's gift of breath in my body. But this is the way I'm constructed. There's no other way to think. I am 2 years behind myself. I should have been 20 when the first thing happened instead of 22. So because he had this like looming, you know, death number in his head, he knew he had to like make it as quickly as he could.
He was quoted as saying once that he wanted to be a legend by 25.
Yeah.
And he essentially was.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, he's happy he's made it, but he's still like kicking himself for not making it sooner, which is crazy.
I'm just looking at pictures in this biography here, and was he considered like a sex symbol at all? Like, because I'm very just looking at him, and I'm like, he's an attractive man, but like, he's not like.
It's Elvis, the voice. It's the confidence. If you go back and look at clips of him on stage,
oh yeah,
It's like a lot of those singers back then. They weren't necessarily like the movie greatest star looking. Hansons.
Yeah,
like even Sinatra wasn't incredibly like a movie star handsome.
Yeah, he was very like tiny, wiry guy. And
yeah.
But, yeah, their talent definitely made them more attractive. And that's interesting that you say that because Bobby actually was very insecure about his looks.
Yeah, he had a double chin. His skin was always splotchy.
And
he was bald.
I thought that he had nice skin on account of all that sex he was having.
Yeah, well, he had to do that because of the blotchy skin.
We were seeing him, like, without all that sex. Like, ooh. And one of the hugest things was Bobby was wearing a toupee by the time he was 20. So, like, when he was on American Bandstand doing Splish Splash, like, he was already wearing
a toupee. Yeah.
So that definitely affected his self-esteem. Bobby thought rock and roll was going to be a fad. He wanted to make sure that he did other genres.
Boy, was he right.
And around 1958, he heard the Louis Armstrong version of Mac the Knife, and he knew he had to record it. And that became like his biggest hit.
Yeah, it was massive. Yeah, it was part of his album. And then when he had this idea to release it as a single, everyone thought he was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're like, if you release that as a single, it's gonna bomb. Anyways, he released it as a single and it became like the number one song in the country.
Yeah, I have it here. It says it went to 1 and stayed there for 9 weeks, and it was in the top 10 for 52 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And he won 2 Grammys that year, Best New Artist and Best Record for Mac the Knife. Unfortunately, around this time, his grandma died. But this is the woman he thought to be his mom. So in his mind, his mother passed away.
Mm.
And that was like a really devastating.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Everything that he did after that was for her. He always had this image in his head. Like, I hope my mom is like looking down on me, and I hope, you know, she sees what I'm doing. So when he found out that she wasn't his mom, I think I might be jumping ahead a little bit, but he said to his actual mom, like, you've robbed me of that.
Yeah.
Which is pretty, pretty intense.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, he's dealing with that, but his career is just going up, and he started working with George Burns.
Yes, yeah. Who is a father figure for him.
Yeah, he became like a mentor and a father figure. And he got together with a guy named Steve Blonner.
Mm-hmm.
And
he was about the same age as him. Yeah. Maybe just a little bit older. They were just two young guys with
no experience whatsoever. So Bobby had two dreams: to play the Copa and to get into films. He played the Copa, and then he got cast in a film called Come September. So we're going to pause there, and I'm going to give you a little bit about Sandra D. Sandra was born Alexandria Zuck in April 23rd. This is interesting. Everywhere you look, it says 1942. Her son, Dodd, says 1944. So her dad was a gambler and a drunk, and her mother, Mary, ended up divorcing him within like the first 5 years of her life. Her mother and Sandra had this very unhealthy relationship. One of the major issues that they had to do with food. Sandra said her mother wrote her own book on child raising. She nursed her until she could unbutton her blouse, and then finally someone said, like, she's too old to live just on breast milk. Like, you have to give this child food. And her mother thought it was, I guess, easier or something to just mix like a raw eggs with milk or oatmeal and just put it all in a bowl, like make a soup out of every meal.
It goes without saying that that sounds fucking disgusting.
Yeah. And so obviously mealtime was just the worst for Sandra. She said that if it took her 3 hours to eat, that's how long it would take. And if she finished at 12:30 and her next meal was at that time, she would have to immediately eat her next meal. This caused eating issues with Sandra from the get-go. Her mother also would dress her in like old clothing, and she embarrassed her at school. And
kind of sounds like Catherine James and what her mother did to her.
Yeah, her mother was like a lonely woman and wanted Sandra around all the time. And yeah, they were like stuck to each other. When I think Sandra was around six or so, Mary got a secretarial job for this real estate entrepreneur named Eugene Dovan. And he was somewhere between like 34 years older than Mary. They ended up dating, falling in love. Right away, like, he would take them to New York. And she says that when they would sleep over, Sandra was forced to sleep in a bed with them, in between them. And she says when she was five, he started molesting her.
Well, like, no shit.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because her mother refused to ever really acknowledge that the abuse happened. She did...
unfortunately, like, not something new to us. Like, when like children had been sexually abused by men that were close to the mother, and the mom just ignores it, like, mm-hmm. just pretends that it doesn't happen, or then even like gets jealous. Mm. Ugh.
Yeah. Even on their wedding night, she was forced to sleep between them. And when she was eight, she says he started like having full intercourse with her and everything. Sandra said her mother would have had to have been deaf and blind not to know something was wrong when I'd come out of the bedroom unbuttoned and asked her to button me up. She says, I did it quite deliberately, but I couldn't just tell her what was happening. In this way, I'm like my mom. Don't say it and it won't be true. So Mary also apparently told everyone Sandra was 2 years older than what she was. So when she was eight, she was passing for 10. She actually went through puberty at eight. She was going to a school for professional children. She, Carol Lindley and Tuesday Wilde, who both became actresses as well, were there, and Carol Lindley says, Sandy and her mom had an unusual relationship. Sandy was an extension of Mary, and Mary had some kind of strange identification with Sandy. Mary used to love to tag along with Sandy on her modeling jobs. To this day, I've never seen a relationship quite like theirs. Sandy was tied to her mother, but Mary was... I liked Mary, but I saw she was raising Sandra as an emotional cripple. So, yeah. And around this time, Sandra started working as a model. And she worked from basically like 9 until, I guess, like 13 or 14. She was very successful. She was making about $78,000 a year by the time she was 10. It was also around this time that Eugene, her stepfather, did something just horrible that so many women, I feel, and maybe men can relate to. One day at breakfast, he patted her tummy and said, "Whoops, it looks like someone's had too many pancakes."
Jesus.
Yeah. And she says, like, he was kidding, but the remark obviously hit hard, and every kid wants to be perfect in their parents' eyes. And from that moment on, she associated fat with bad. And she did everything she could to destroy her body. She said she found it easy to restrict her food. And it's a really interesting thing is, if you go back and you look at old magazine articles, even when Sandra was in Hollywood making pictures and everything, so many articles, like, her eating disorder is just laid out. They talk about her 6 shrimp a day diet or her vitamin pill diet. One talked about her lunch being a hard boiled egg and half a head of lettuce with vinegar when feeling reckless. Yeah. And her makeup crew would bribe her, like, a new lipstick if she had a dinner or whatever. So, yeah, her eating disorder is like in full swing at this point. She's really suffering. Mm-hmm. When she was 12, Eugene died. So the abuse stopped. Everyone thought she was 14, but she was actually 12. And it's this year also that she got a audition. A guy named Ross Hunter loved her, took her to LA. Apparently, he held the contract. MGM wasn't sold on her, but after Sandra was cast in a film with Paul Newman called Until They Sail, everyone realized she was a star. There's a really funny story I just want to mention. Because of her diet, they had to make a rubber bodysuit for Sandra, because in the movie she ages from 12 to 18. And apparently she was so excited about this fake rubber woman body that when she tried it on, she yelled out of her dressing room, Mr. Newman, do you want to see my body? She's in Hollywood now. She had one horrific experience while filming her first picture. She overdid her head of lettuce diet, and her renal system shut down due to lack of protein. And her body became so swollen that she her pants literally split at the seams. They had to add protein to her diet, and she recovered from that. After that, though, she started getting roles nonstop. Lots of teeny kind of roles. So she was doing things like Gidget, A Summer Place, and the Tammy series. And Imitation of Life, once that came out, it like made her a top box office earner. And in 1960, Sandra was 16 years old. She got cast in Come September. Mm-hmm. So she went off to Italy. And love awaited her.
Well, yeah, love that she was very much against.
Yes.
Also, it was tough. Bobby fell in love with her sort of immediately.
Mm-hmm.
But her overbearing mother was there 24/7.
Yeah.
So Bobby sort of had to woo the mother, and then he...
he knew to get to Sandra, he had to get through Mary.
Charlie was with him, and he sort of took the mother on dates so that Bobby could be alone.
Distract the mother.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the book, it says the first time Sandy and Bobby saw each other, he was in a yellow suit, like part of the costume, I think. And he was on shore, and Sandra was in a boat that was docking, and he yelled, "Will you marry me?" And she yelled, "Not today." And apparently he basically asked her that every day until she said yes. So, yeah, Bobby wooed Mary. Then he finally got Sandra, was not into him.
No, not at all.
She thought
he was being a dick.
Yeah. He was a cocky 24-year-old at that point. Mm. So, yeah, she was just like, get lost. But then her mother, actually, because Bobby wooed her so well, convinced Sandra to go out on a date with him, because she said, like, you're embarrassing yourself and everything. Mm. So Sandra went out on this one date, and sparks flew. And after that, they were together, basically. Mm-hmm. So they told their close friends and everyone they were going to get married. No one was happy about it, but they knew once Bobby set his mind to something.
Oh, of course, yeah.
That was it. After the film wrapped, they came back. They were supposed to be married in 3 months, but Bobby had another idea. One night at dinner, he said, "If you really love me, you'll have a blood test." And she was like, "Well, we're not getting married for months. Like, why?" But she did it anyway. And when she came home and her mother saw the Band-Aid, she knew right away, like, what was going on. And she flipped out. And apparently she packed her clothes, left. And she and Sandra didn't speak for, like, 4 months after that, I think. But Sandra and Bobby... we're going to get married in New Jersey. So they drove over there. He had a red Rolls Royce, I think.
Something like that.
Yeah. So the paparazzi were like following them there. And then they got there and the judge was there, but they had no marriage license. So like they had to like at midnight find someone to do the marriage license. And finally they found someone and then they drove back. And apparently they ended up getting married at like 4 a.m. They went out for breakfast after in Newark. And she said,
very
like,
romantic.
Yeah, right. She said it was like a Keystone Cops kind of night and like not at all how she expected her wedding day to be. Obviously, the wedding night, Sandra was terrified. She didn't tell Bobby about what had happened to her as a kid. She would eventually, but after they had divorced and apparently he was very... upset, obviously, mm-hmm. and they had a tender...
They remained close until he died.
Yes, yeah. Yes. But and apparently their wedding night was great, and she said that when she woke up...
I was going to make a really shitty joke there, and I was just like... And then I put my hand and be like, no, don't pass the microphone over to me.
All right.
But glad that... No, fuck it, I'm not doing it.
Okay. she said she never felt that safe as that night when she was in Bobby's arms. And Bobby said, now that I'm married, I care about living. I finally found someone who is more important to me than myself. All the running and searching and proving have come to a halt with Sandy. So they were married December 1st, 1960. Sandra was 16, mm-hmm. posing as 18, I guess.
Yeah.
And Bobby was 24. They'd only known each other 3 months. Within the first month, they had their big blowout, I quit fight. And Sandra also had a miscarriage within the first month of their relationship. So that was hard. Bobby and Sandra had very different ideas of, I guess, what a marriage was going to be like.
Mm-hmm.
Bobby was still very much focused on his career.
Oh, yeah.
Sandra did have that old-fashioned, like, I want to come home and, like, have my husband come home and tell me about his day. And
she was also incredibly busy with pictures, though, so
yes.
Her scheduling was ridiculous.
So, yeah, they really, she says like the only time she could really see him was at his shows. During one of his shows at the Copa, Sandy had her first ever drink when she was like 16 at this time. It was a screwdriver and she loved it. And she had a second drink and she loved that and a third. And she ended up in the bathroom the whole night, of course. But she liked the effect that the alcohol had. But she got pregnant really soon after that. And she had Dodd, who wrote the book Dream Lovers.
I feel kind of bad for her that like the only time that she got to see her husband was at his shows, because as much as I like going to shows, if you're going with somebody that like you're sleeping with or that is like one of your people or that's your boyfriend, it's like one of the worst times to hang out with somebody is like when a musician who's working,
especially someone like Bobby, because he was so like focused, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think he really liked people around him before a show and everything.
Well, he and anytime he was not on stage was a time where it was very quiet for him.
Mm-hmm. But things were good at this point. They had Dodd in 1961. She was unconscious when she had him, so she has no memory. Dodd had been Bobby's childhood nickname, so that's why they named him that. It was around this time also that Sandra started to kind of become a little bit of a recluse, just wanted to be at home and all that. Bobby, at this point, was getting one of his biggest wishes. He was cast in a film called Captain Newman, M.D. Mm-hmm. And he won, or he was nominated.
He was nominated for Best Supporting Actor.
Yeah, and he lost to Melvin Douglas that year.
Melvin Douglas.
Which apparently was a blow.
Yeah, it was essentially sort of like, you're old, here's your Oscar.
Yeah.
And Bobby really, really got upset about
that. Was upset about that, yeah. And especially because he had that thing in his head, like, I need to do these things.
It's a really incredible performance. Mm. I don't know if you've seen it.
I have, yeah.
Yeah, it's really powerful for a guy who had never acted before.
Absolutely. And, yeah, he definitely deserved a bigger career in film than he had.
Mm. He just didn't have time.
Or as Alex called it so cutely, pictures.
Pictures.
Pictures. You're going to be in pictures.
Yes. And Sandra and Bobby did two pictures after Come September, That Funny Feeling and If a Man Answers.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't really that big a success, I don't think.
They were, you know.
They're fluff. Cute. I love them. They're adorable together. Like, you can see their love, I feel. I would definitely recommend them if people are interested.
It was also an opportunity for them to be on the same schedule.
Yes, and that was sort of one way that they were trying to make their marriage work at this point. And at Bobby's suggestion, Sandra went to see a psychiatrist for her eating issues. And after one session, the doctor asked if he could speak to Bobby. A few hours after that, Sandra got a phone call from Charlie saying that Bobby wanted a divorce. He refused to speak to her. Basically, the therapist told Bobby, not all Sandra's issues are her own. Like, in your marriage, you're responsible as well. And Bobby couldn't handle that. And
how old is Dodd at this point?
Dodd was maybe like two.
Probably like two or three.
Yeah. Apparently he also thought Sandra was having an affair with Peter Fonda. I don't know if that's like...
Probably not true.
I mean, she definitely didn't have the affair, but whether he believed it or not, I'm not sure. During this period, Bobby moved to New York. He set up a record publishing company at that point.
I think he bought a record.
He bought one?
He bought a record publishing company.
He became like a businessman first and a singer second at that point. When he kept finding new talent.
Yeah, like Wayne Newton and stuff like that.
Yeah. Apparently, I think Doncashay was...
Doncashay, yeah, that was for Bobby, and then he passed it along to Wayne Newton, and then literally that one song was what made Wayne Newton's career take off. But Bobby, like, said, I don't need this song, so he passed it along.
That's amazing.
So, like, the vibes that I'm getting right now, based on coming into this, not knowing either of them, is that, like, they're both very talented, but Bobby's kind of a dick, and Sandra's kind of a sweet angel.
Yeah, but Sandra, at this point, like, she wasn't a sweet angel. She outwardly was, but she got very heavily into, first of all, she had her eating disorders, and then she got heavily into alcohol. She became an alcoholic, and she also had a gambling problem. Mm-hmm. She says she did that basically to get Bobby's attention.
Bobby's attention, yeah.
You have to remember, she was still like a teenager at this point. Like, she had her son, I think she was like 17, mm-hmm. 18. Mm-hmm. And yeah, she'd never lived away from her mother. She didn't know how to be an adult because she wasn't an adult. And so they both had their issues, but they both very much loved each other. And yeah, Bobby was a dick, but he was also young, and he had his...
Whoa.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, he definitely had qualities of not being nice to people, but
he was very determined.
He's very determined. He did an incredible amount of stuff for other people too.
Yes, and he did very much shift over time.
Good. I'm glad that you both kind of proved me wrong on both of those, because that's just kind of how it was feeling. Yeah. So it's nice to know that the tide's about to turn.
Everyone's very complicated in general.
Yes. So about 4 months after he'd left LA and they broke up, he called Sandra again. They patched things up. He knew that if he wanted to be with her, he'd have to tone down his lifestyle. So he kind of cut out some ties with friends and people, and he stopped
doing nightclub performances. He stopped doing everything.
Yeah, he stopped touring,
just so he could be with his family.
Yeah. So and Sandra, she was still doing Tommy pictures and things like that, and she was like 19 at this point. Things were like better than ever. Bobby did do some club performances here and there, and they were always big successes. But it was around this time that Bobby once again was like, I want a divorce. Once again, he did not tell her. He got someone else to tell her. Apparently this time it happened after they'd went to a party, and Sandra talked to Warren Beatty for a while, and Bobby was jealous, and something happened where it clicked in his head that they couldn't be together. They separated. They got a divorce in 67. He would still come back to her, though, until around 1970. They were kind of still on and off. She had another miscarriage in 1970, and that was like ended it for good. But they were still very close. Sandra kind of lost her career at this time. Her contract was done with Universal. Her mother re-entered her life. But this is where Bobby really shifted. He was always ahead of his time. He was always like trying to end racial discrimination. He always hired black comedians for his openers. And he was getting political.
Mm-hmm. He was very much into the Robert Kennedy's campaign.
Mm-hmm.
He really, really believed in what he was saying and what he was doing. He marched with Martin Luther King Jr. He did all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, he was. And so when Kennedy was killed, that was like a massive blow.
It changed everything. It was around the time when he found out his sister was actually his mother.
Yes.
So that the Kennedy death was sort of the final deciding blow to.
Mm-hmm.
Completely become a recluse and change his life. And
yeah, he also accrued a FBI file of like 96 pages long by the time he was dead, so that kind of shows just how active he was.
Oh yeah, politically. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, Nina told him, I'm your mother. He never really accepted it, or he accepted it but never looked at her as a mother. And yeah, so after Bobby died, Kennedy died, he moved to Big Sur. He lived in a trailer. He threw away the tux. He threw away the hairpiece. He grew a mustache. He became like a kind of a little bit of a hippie.
Oh, total hippie.
And he began singing and writing like anti-war songs and protest songs. And
and he went by Bob Darin, not Bobby Darin anymore.
Yeah. And critics were impressed. He put out 2 albums.
So the critics loved his albums. The people did not love his albums. No. Because they wanted Bobby Darin. So.
And yeah, they'd show up wanting to hear Mac the Knife and instead hear.
You'd tell
like
them
a,
no, yeah.
But don't want the war.
Yeah, he was essentially just wearing like jeans and like an open shirt with a mustache.
And he also decided to put all his money into making a film. And apparently that was a disaster.
Yeah, that film didn't work out for him.
He kind of lost all his money, but he got a gig shortly after, and he ended up having to kind of compromise on his image.
Yeah, he decided people hear what they see.
Yes.
So he put the tuxedo back on, he put the hairpiece back on, he went back to Bobby Darin.
Yeah.
He still performed the protest songs, but everybody loved them just because he looked Bobby Darin.
That's crazy. Pretty fascinating. Yeah. And Wayne Newton actually came back in the picture and helped him out. He wasn't really booking tours and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And Wayne sort of called in a favor.
Back in Vegas. Yeah.
And that was a success, I think.
Also, at this point, as much as Bobby might have gone back to Bobby Darin just for, you know, the reasons we just talked about, there's a very hard truth that he told his manager. He said, I need to go back to being Bobby Darin because I don't want to wait in medical lines, because his heart was failing. He needed another surgery very soon, and that was going to cost a lot of money. So he's like, if I become Bobby Darin again, I'm going to get money, and it's going to help me for surgery.
Yeah.
That's essentially why he did it, too.
And he did have surgery right after that. The surgery was a success.
Yeah. Right before the surgery, there is a TV special he did in Toronto, actually, of all places. And in between filming in Toronto, he was in the wings and he was essentially like passing out and couldn't breathe and like pale white.
Yeah, and it should be known, like throughout his entire career, he was very lively on stage, but a lot of times afterwards...
He was taking oxygen backstage.
Yeah, his heart did affect him, like, all his career. But because he was so lively always, no one really almost believed how sick he was. Mm. Like, his friends didn't realize. He had the heart surgery. He also, around this time, like, in 1970, met a woman named Andrea Yeager.
Who he divorced on his deathbed.
Yeah. They got married in 1973, and about 4 months later, through some crazy... But we'll get to that. He had the first heart surgery, and then he had another triumph at the Copa, and NBC offered him a variety show. He had a variety show for a while.
I think he ended up taking Dean Martin's slot from his big show.
And that was a success. But it's also, and I have no idea why he would do this, but around this time, he decided to go to the dentist, and people with his heart condition are supposed to take antibiotics every time they go to the dentist, to make sure the bacteria doesn't get in the bloodstream. It's very important. He decided not to take...
So he was on a bunch of medication at that time. And the medication he was on was actually fucking with his mind. Mm-hmm. So there was an instance where, this is like right before he died, probably like within 6 months, he took Dodd to, I think it was a bike store or something. And like Bobby was like completely out of it because he was on all these medications and he was very close to death. And then he just left his kid there. The kid's like 12 and like his dad never came back. And like he needed to phone his mom and she came and picked him up and like, they found Bobby wandering around the streets, like, not really knowing what was going on.
Yeah. Apparently, he stopped taking the anticoagulants that he was on as well, and that kind of caused, like, blood clots in the brain, which...
This is so sad. There's so much about this story that it's, like...
Yeah.
Man.
They're kind of tragic. And, yeah, it's something that, like, could have been helped. I mean...
Oh, yeah, 100%.
if he'd just taken the antibiotics, but he didn't.
He didn't have anyone around him to sort of push him to do that.
Yeah. So, yeah, he got very ill. For 2 months leading up to his death, he didn't even let his friends see him and not even his son.
According to the book, his son wrote that he was essentially just, like, in bed, and he withered down to, like, 112 pounds and just ridiculous, ridiculous stuff.
And as you said, he divorced Andrea. That was kind of part of his erratic behavior. He asked Andrea and his friend to go to a doctor with him and tell them, like, everything that's been going on. And they did. And then when the doctor suggested, like, he go get some treatment, he thought his brain decided that was, like, a conspiracy against him. And he cut out his friend and divorced Andrea. So it was, like, a terrible...
I will say, this is after his last television series. Mm-hmm. And his last television series for the variety show, they shot it like a concert, which they don't usually do. Usually have guests come in and they do bits and stuff, but he shot a full concert because he knew in his mind that it was going to be the last show that he would ever do, at least filmed. And there's moments in the show where he's literally giving everything he can, and he's like shaking his hand over and over again because he can't feel it. He's trying to get the circulation going. Yeah.
Wow.
So he's essentially dying on stage.
Yeah. Which is something he wanted to do, apparently.
No, maybe, yeah.
So, yeah, Dodd was 12 when his dad died. Bobby died on December 3rd, 1973, at the age of 37. Yeah. Before he died, he gave Sandra and Dodd a suitcase and told them, don't open it until I've passed. When they did, they found precious mementos, things from Bobby's childhood, letters he treasured from both Sandra and Dodd. He had a lock of Sandy's hair and articles he'd cut out from magazines, like, all throughout their marriage. And he even had the first magazine cover Sandra ever did when she was, like, 8 or 9 years old in there. This obviously meant the world to Sandy. It was, you know, a confirmation of their mutual love, and she took his death hard. So did Dodd. She became a bigger recluse. She was deep into the alcohol at this point. Dodd tried to help his mom, but because Sandra's mom was the way that Sandra's mom is, he would go to his grandma and be like, please, like, we got to get her help. And Mary would be like, she doesn't need it. And then later on, she'd be like, oh, Sandra's too drunk. We can't discuss it with her now. And then when she'd be sober, she'd be like, well, it's a nice moment now. Let's not ruin it by talking about this, right? So Sandra really never got the help that she needed. And apparently she also finally confronted her mother about the sexual abuse, which her mother also continued to deny. So that was something they were all living with. When Dodd was a teen, he sort of rebelled. He became the typical, I mean, it would be hard to go through all of that and not have a rebellion stage. But by the time he was in his 20s, their relationship got a lot better. In 1987, Mary, Sandra's mother, ended up passing away. She once again chose to ignore her illness until it was too late. Sandra, again, another huge blow. Apparently she didn't leave the house for 4 months, and she ended up dropping to 80 pounds, and she started throwing up blood. And finally Dodd was like, you have to get help. So she finally went in, she got treatment, she stopped drinking, she began eating properly. And in 1991, People magazine kind of did a spotlight on her. And that was the first time she ever opened up publicly discussing her childhood, her anorexia, her alcoholism, everything. She just, and the huge outpouring from the world, you know, everyone just gave her a big hug, basically, and she was on Sally Jesse Raphael, which you can go on YouTube and watch the whole thing. Again, she discusses all of that, and that was a big success. And John Saxton, who was in two of Sandra's first two films, I think, or in her first few, he actually was there, and he offered Sandra a role in a play that he was in, so she worked again. She'd hoped that it would lead to more acting roles in film, but it didn't. And over the past few years, she did kind of relapse and everything, but she got better. She called doing the play and, you know, coming out and doing... Yeah, I can hear. Sorry, my cat's...
Howling.
Yeah.
He's a singer.
Yeah. He's crooning. She said that that was the proudest moment of her life. So that was really a wonderful time. And in 1994, Dodd Darren wrote this book that we've pretty much got most of this material from. It's called Dream Lovers, The Magnificent Shattered Lives of Buddy Darren and Sandra Dee. Sandra really helped and supported him making this, and she said it was like a really eye-opening experience, and it sort of helped her come to terms with some things. And Dodd married a woman that he had known since his childhood, and he made Sandra Dee a grandmother. She has, she had two granddaughters. In 2000, Sandra was diagnosed with throat cancer and kidney failure. All the years of smoking and drinking caught up. She did battle the cancer, but in 2005, she passed away from kidney disease. And Dodd runs both of their estates now. And in 2004, Beyond the Sea came out.
Mm-hmm.
Kate Bosworth is Sandra, and Kevin Spacey is...
Bobby Darren.
Bobby. Yep. Do you love that film?
It's a great film.
Yeah.
It's really good. It doesn't tell... It's not a biopic in the sense of going through year by year. It's sort of a dream-like representation of everything that he was. It's mm-hmm. It's really well done.
Yeah, and Bobby kind of always said, like, don't look back, or memories are like what we make of them. And so the film's kind of really fitting in that sense where... Mm. And it does follow their romance, but it's really a biopic on Bobby. I would say. And Kevin Spacey is amazing in it.
He's fantastic, yeah.
And he sings all the songs.
They look very much like each
they
other.
They do. Mm-hmm. He really, and he sounds like him. Like I was so impressed. I highly recommend that. And I read recently that Dodd is looking into creating like a TV episodic.
I read about that too, yeah.
On his parents' lives. So maybe that will come out eventually. For people who want to hear more of Bobby Darren's work, if they haven't checked him out before.
Oh, go on YouTube. It is incredible stuff.
Any in particular that you would recommend?
Oh, gosh. There's just click something and see where it leads you. Because yeah. It is incredible.
He made, like, I don't even know how many albums and songs all together.
He was a very complicated individual, but you have to remember that he knew he was going to die very soon compared to a lot of people. Like, he knew it was going to happen.
Yeah.
So if you know you're going to die, don't people say that all the time? Like, if you knew you were going to die at this date, wouldn't you do something about it? So he did something about
it. Yeah, he's such a great example of, like, being determined and wanting something, and, like, he made it all happen.
Sometimes you have to, or you can't necessarily be present in all aspects of your life if you're doing that, but it's sort of the price you pay, I guess.
Yeah. And now you're going out and making it happen.
Well, we'll see. I don't know when I'm going to die, though.
Well, hey, as long as we all, like, live it up while we're here.
Right? He's definitely an inspiration of mine to remembering that the time we have here is borrowed time.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
why not make something of it?
thank you so much for joining us for this.
Of course, thank you for having me.
When I first thought of doing this episode, like, you immediately sprung to mind. Mm-hmm. You're a very good example of a modern day Bobby Darin.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
I have real hair though. I have a toupee
and gorgeous hair too.
Thank you very much.
Do you want to tell people where they can find you?
Well, my stuff is, I have a YouTube page, just search up Alex Bird. Also, alexbird.net is my website, updated with all my acting and singing stuff. But all my music is on my YouTube page. You can check it out.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll definitely put up the link.
Thank you so much for coming and telling me this story. I learned a lot. It was a good story. And I don't know, my heart's feeling it's feeling some things right now. So I'm going to go to the park and spend some time with my family.
Yeah, and check out Sandra Dee's films. I'm sure most people kind of only know of her through the Grease song.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which now seems kind of pretty ironic and it's just not accurate. Virginal Sandra Dee,
that was the image. Yikes. That was the Hollywood image.
It was
image.
The image, but it was not the accurate representation, yeah. Which it often is, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I think it was a great shock when she actually came out in the 90s and admitted all of this. But but people still loved her and supported her. And
well, the work always speaks for itself more than anything else.
Yeah, and she got to, you know, be with her grandkids and her son. And
so, yeah, it was kind of a nice ending for her.
I forgot to say, and it's important, I think, she was never again with another man. Bobby was her only.
Well.
Makes sense.
Well, thank you so much, guys. And thank you, everybody, for listening. You can find us online on Facebook and Instagram at Muses and Stuff Podcast. And you can follow Lynx and I on Twitter at Shanti and Lynx.
All right. Thank you, Alex.
You're welcome.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. Wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to season one, we are thrilled to announce the launch of season two. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you, and let's make season two even more memorable together.